your brother Vladimir Diesel Ogaya, and welcome to the Class War Battlefield Podcast. When I started this show in 2011, my goal was to inform. Obviously, the show has evolved, a lot of new topics, a lot of new thoughts, taking on metaphysics, some spirituality, hitting you with all types of things that you may have never heard of, and some that you have. It's always lively. But now I'm coming to you to ask you to help me prolong this podcast. For years, I have been producing this podcast for free on your behalf. I am now coming to you to ask you to support this work. $2, $5, $10, $20, $50, whatever you can do, please do.
And now,
the definition. Definition.
The latest fighting in Gaza and the U.S. blocking a U.N. motion demanding an immediate ceasefire, as we're learning new details this morning about a failed operation to rescue hostages kidnapped by Hamas. ABC's Tom Sufi Burridge is in Tel Aviv with the latest on the ground. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Errol. Yes, some really sad news just in of the death of another Israeli hostage. And as this exhibition here in Tel Aviv shows, there'll be lots of empty places at dinner tables this Hanukkah weekend as the suffering and fighting inside Gaza intensifies and the U.S. moves to block calls for a ceasefire at the U.N.
Dramatic images emerging this morning of the aftermath of an Israeli missile strike. With the U.S. blocking a call for another ceasefire in Gaza at the U.N. This morning, Israel thanking the U.S. for using its veto, halting a Security Council resolution for an immediate ceasefire.
Although the United States strongly supports a durable peace in which both Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and security, we do not support this resolution's call for an unsustainable ceasefire that will only plant the seeds for the next war.
With Israel intensifying its assault in areas of Gaza, the death toll rising to around 17,500 people, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. And that U.S. move at the U.N. to block a potential ceasefire, sparking anger. This man accusing the U.S. of being against the people who are being killed day and night, he says, by American weapons. Here, desperate scenes after 15 members of one family were killed in an Israeli strike. With the UN's World Food Programme warning, half of the population in Gaza is starving.
The humanitarian operation is collapsing.
Casualties streaming into this hospital in Khan Yunis. Israel saying it's moving to eradicate Hamas strongholds in that southern city. Injured children being treated on the hospital's floor as the US pressures Israel to do more to protect civilian lives.
It remains imperative that Israel put a premium on civilian protection. And there does remain a gap between exactly what I said when I was there, the intent to protect civilians, and the actual results that we're seeing on the ground.
And amid the fighting, news just in this morning of the death of another Israeli hostage, Sacha Baruch. It comes after the IDF said overnight it raided a Hamas hideout where hostages were being held, but no one was rescued in the operation.
Well, the IDF so far not commenting on whether Sacha Baruch was killed in that failed attempt to rescue Israeli hostages. The Hostages Family Forum releasing a statement saying he was murdered in Gaza, his brother killed in that October 7th terror attack. Gio?
Just so much pain 2 months in. All right, Tom, thank you so much.
Strike. With the U.S. blocking a call for another ceasefire in Gaza at the U.N. This morning, Israel thanking the U.S. for using its veto, halting a Security Council resolution for an immediate ceasefire.
Although the United States strongly supports a durable peace in which both Israelis and Palestinians...
The United Nations Security Council has been meeting regularly over the past week to discuss the Russian-Ukrainian war. There's been growing frustration with the Council as the resolutions presented by the various member states have all been vetoed by Russia, which itself is a party to the conflict. But how exactly does the United Nations Security Council work? Hey everyone, I'm Noah Zerbe. I'm a professor of global politics at California State Polytechnic University Humboldt. In this video series, I try to explain the concepts and theories behind current events, all in 2 minutes or less. When the United Nations was established at the end of World War II, it enshrined a compromise among the major powers of the day and calcified the existing global power structure. The Security Council was created to address threats to international peace and security. The Council has 5 permanent members: China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. In addition, there are 10 non-permanent or rotating members elected on a regional basis by the General Assembly. Thus, Africa has 3 non-permanent seats on the Council, the Asia-Pacific region also has 3, Latin America and the Caribbean have 2 seats, and so on. Under most circumstances, the Security Council is the only United Nations body that has the power to enforce its decisions. The decisions of all other UN bodies are merely recommendations to the member states. Decisions of the Council require at least 9 of the 15 states on the Security Council to vote in favor of a proposal. In addition, Article 23 of the United Nations Charter establishes the requirement for great power unanimity, meaning that the 5 permanent members on the Council can veto any item under consideration by the Council merely by voting against it. The Council can call additional UN member states to participate in the discussions of the Council. These invited participants do not have a vote. This occurs most often when a state is party to a conflict or has a vested interest in the outcome of a matter under consideration. Thus, the Security Council invited the Ukrainian permanent representative, or the ambassador, to participate in the sessions of the Council which dealt with the Russian-Ukrainian war. And in an additional twist, the presidency of the Council rotates between the member states, with each Council member holding the rotating presidency for a month before the position is passed on to the next state in line. In the current situation, this led to Russia holding the presidency of the Council while it debated Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The presidency rotated to the United Arab Emirates at the beginning of March, and then to the United Kingdom in April, the United States in May, and so on. Normally, the Council presidency is merely a symbolic position, though Council presidents will sometimes use the position to focus on a specific issue of interest to that state. Any member state may request the Security Council take up an issue, and the Council may add an agenda item by simply a majority vote. It seems likely the situation in Ukraine will continue to occupy the Security Council's agenda for some time.
The United Nations Security Council has, for the 3rd time this week, postponed a vote on a resolution calling for a halt to the fighting in Gaza and for Israel to allow shipments of food, water, fuel, and medicine into the besieged territory. Several Security Council members have expressed frustration with the United States for repeatedly delaying votes and for threatening to once again veto any resolution.
We're joined now by Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, serves as an international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace. Phyllis has written a number of books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, her recent piece for In These Times, headlined The Christmas Truce of 1914 and the Demand for a Ceasefire in Gaza. As we went to air today, Phyllis, there is no resolution at this point at the UN. One is expected today, but we said that Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. If you can talk about what's going on there, and then we can talk about that Christmas truce as we move into the weekend.
This is, in some ways, a very old story. The United States refuses to accept a globally demanded ceasefire in the context of Israeli assaults, particularly on Gaza. And we've seen it before. We're seeing it again now. The U.S. is refusing to allow the term cessation of hostilities. They certainly will not allow the term ceasefire to be used. They want to talk about a suspension of hostilities, meaning just a temporary pause like we saw 2 weeks ago, to allow in a certain amount of aid, reduce the pressure on Israel, get some of the hostages released, and then go back to the Israeli assault and kill more thousands of Palestinians, presumably. So what we're looking at is the question of whether the other members of the Security Council will be able to persuade the U.S., and I think this is very doubtful, to change their position and allow decent language about a real cessation of hostilities or a ceasefire. And if they don't, will the Council go ahead and force the United States to use its veto, something the U.S. does not like to do, or will it essentially collapse under its own pressure and simply withdraw the resolution and say, well, we couldn't get the U.S. on board, so we're not going to go forward. The issue then becomes whether you're letting the U.S. off the hook by saying, we will simply, we'll simply withdraw the resolution, or do you force the U.S. to use its veto, which then has consequences, including sending the resolution off to the General Assembly, where it passes under very particular conditions that can make it much more influential and, by some arguments by legal scholars, perhaps enforceable, like a Security Council resolution would be. So that's where the Council is right now.
And Phyllis, so if you could explain that, because normally a General Assembly vote is not legally binding in the way that a Security Council right. vote is, which is why there's so much emphasis on what the Security Council does.
The particularity here, Nermeen, is that when the U.S. or any other of the five permanent members of the Council actually uses a veto, a new regulation at the U.N. that was passed a couple of years ago requires that the General Assembly then meet within 10 days to take up that same issue. You know, ordinarily, this is very closely held. The Security Council deals with threats to peace and security around the world. The General Assembly can deal with everything else. But when one of the five permanent members, in this case, of course, the United States, uses its veto on an issue of peace and security, under those conditions, the General Assembly is required to hold an emergency session, and it's held under what's known in the UN as the Uniting for Peace precedent. This was something the UN was forced to accept back in 1951 at the instigation, ironically, of the United States. It's how the U.S. got the United Nations to endorse its war in Korea. And under those conditions, the decisions made by the General Assembly, which officially are considered non-binding, not enforceable, take on additional power because it's derivative of United Nations Security Council power. So the decisions are uncertain whether it's really enforceable. But it's a much stronger resolution in the General Assembly if it follows a veto in the Security Council. That's one of the big reasons why the United States does not like to use its veto if it can avoid it. The other reason, of course, is that it shows the world just how isolated the United States now is. The U.S. and Israel stand alone. The vote in the General Assembly on a very similar resolution was 153 countries out of 193 who voted yes. And only 10 countries, including the U.S. and Israel, voted no. And under those circumstances, it really demonstrates the isolation of the U.S., and that's not something that the Biden administration is eager to be showing up again.
Well, if you could say, Phyllis, I mean, talk about the significance of U.S. support. Explain why it's so strident, despite what's happening in Gaza. And also the fact that when Biden did lightly criticize Israel for its indiscriminate bombardment, saying that it was losing international support, the Israeli foreign minister very quickly said that Israel would continue, quote, with or without international support. Your response to that, I mean, is that accurate, you think?
Right. Well, I think what is true is that the United States has made a number of polite requests of the Israeli government. They have said, please stop killing so many people. What you're doing is okay. Using massive bombardment is okay. But try and pull back a little bit, maybe change the tactics of the ground invasion so that you're not killing quite so many civilians. It doesn't look good. But there are no consequences when the Israeli response, as you just said from Prime Minister Netanyahu or others, is simply, no, we're going to continue what we're doing. There's no way that Israel feels compelled to respond to that until the requests become requirements. And the requirements come with conditions that make a difference. So that when the United States says, you've got to stop bombing Gaza, you're killing civilians and it's illegal under international law, you've got to stop. And Israel says, nope, we're going to continue, then the next sentence out of the mouth of President Biden or Secretary of State Blinken or whoever is relaying that message is, okay, then you know those billions of dollars we send to your military every year? You can kiss that goodbye. And you know how we've been protecting you at the International Criminal Court so you're never held accountable for war crimes? We're not doing that anymore. So those are the kinds of things that will begin to have a real impact on Israel. As long as the Israelis are clear that the Biden position of what we might call bear hug diplomacy where the symbolism of his embrace physically and politically of Netanyahu and the Israeli state is, we have your back, we will protect you no matter what, but please make a few amendments. They have no reason to take that seriously because the U.S. doesn't express it seriously.
I want to turn to U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken speaking Wednesday in D.C. at a State Department briefing.
I hear virtually no one saying, demanding of Hamas that it stop hiding behind civilians, that it lay down its arms, that it surrender. This is over tomorrow if Hamas does that. This would have been over a month ago, 6 weeks ago, if Hamas had done that. And how could it be? How can it be that there are no demands made of the aggressor and only demands made of the victim?
Phyllis Bennis, your response.
You know, it's ironic that the Secretary of State of Israel's biggest supporter, the provider of 20% of its entire military budget, among other things, will move forward to say that it's that there's the need for the people of Gaza, because this war is against the people of Gaza. It is not just against Hamas. That's simply not the case. The notion that the U.S. is saying that the demand should be made on Hamas, when it's been the United States backing of Israel that has allowed Israel to impose a siege on Gaza for 17 years, we should be clear, this siege did not begin on October 7th. It was escalated after the atrocities that were committed on October 7th, for sure. But this had been going on for 17 years, harshly enough that 20% of all children in Gaza were stunted by the age of two because they could not get sufficient food necessary for children to thrive. That was way before October 7th. So we have to look at this in the context of the ongoing war that Israel has been waging in Gaza, against the people of Palestine. And it's a war that has become genocidal in its impact. So this notion that Secretary of State Blinken, who is desperately trying to divert the focus of U.S. outrage, global outrage at Israel and at the United States for enabling the Israeli war crimes to continue, he's using every possibility that he can. The negotiations are underway between Israel and Hamas in Cairo, with Egypt and Qatar as interlocutors. There's other negotiations underway, of course, at the United Nations, as we've been discussing. But the bottom line is that Israel has killed 20,000 people, 70% of them, children and women. And that doesn't even count the thousands of people that have been killed under the rubble when Israeli bombs have destroyed buildings and homes over people's bodies. So we're looking at something that has never happened at this scale in this century. And that has to be our focus. That's why we need a ceasefire. You're not going to be able to protect the hostages and bring them home without a ceasefire. You're not going to be able to bring in sufficient aid to make it possible to stop what is now real starvation in Gaza. We have not seen that before, even under the siege. We have not seen actual starvation. And now the United Nations World Food Program is saying that more than half of the families in Gaza are starving and that 90% are food insecure. That doesn't exist anywhere in the world right now, where 50% of a population is starving. And that's what has to stop. And that's why we need a ceasefire to end those realities.
And finally, Phyllis, we just have a minute. If you could respond to the New York Times-Siena poll that was released earlier this week, where it's clear that the majority of Americans are opposed to the Biden administration's policy, but in a perplexing finding, a number of them say that they would, in the 2024 election, vote for Trump instead as a result.
I can't explain it. I don't know exactly what the question was that they asked. And that's always a key part of how they get answers like this. But I think what's key is the first thing you said, Nermeen, there is massive opposition in this country to what the Biden administration is doing. 80% of Democrats, President Biden's own party, want a ceasefire now. We're seeing massive opposition within the State Department, within the White House, the White House interns, these young, ambitious students, high school and college students, the youngest of the federal workforce, came out publicly and said, we are not the leaders of today, but we aspire to lead in the future, and we cannot stand by and watch this genocide being perpetuated by Israel with our support. That's extraordinary. That's never been seen before in this country. And that's why we say that not only is the U.S. isolated at the United Nations, but the Biden administration on this issue is massively isolated within the United States itself.
Everyone's heard of the United Nations, but many don't know how it actually works and facilitates international diplomacy. So, in this video, we'll briefly explain the history of how and why the UN was created, the principal organs that make up the international body, and how they function day to day. And if you're interested in more topics about international law and diplomacy, then let us know in the comments down below and be sure to subscribe to the channel so you never miss an upload going forward. So, following World War I, countries wanted to avoid a repeat of the horrific global conflict, and their leaders formed the League of Nations, dedicated to preventing the outbreak of further wars. As would become catastrophically obvious mere decades later, the League wasn't fit for purpose, largely because the United States refused to join, instead preferring the isolationism advocated by the framers. However, the US didn't really account for the effects its new status as a major power would have on global order if it remained isolated. The weakened League of Nations was wholly ineffective in its task of preventing another large-scale conflict. Once again, the world was rocked by world war, this time with even more disastrous consequences. During the final months of the war, states came together to create an international organization more effective at preventing conflict, and the United Nations was born. On the 24th of October 1945, the United Nations came into existence following the ratification of the UN Charter by the five main allies, the United States, the United Kingdom, France, the Soviet Union, and China, as well as a majority of other signatories. On January the 10th, 1946, the General Assembly met for the first time in Methodist Central Hall in Westminster, and the Security Council met for the first time a week later. A week after that, the General Assembly adopted the first UN resolution, establishment of a commission to deal with the problems raised by the discovery of atomic energy. This committee is composed of the members of the Security Council, and, when it's not on the Council, Canada. We mentioned the General Assembly and the Security Council, but what exactly are they? The UN has six principal organs that oversee the organisation's main functions: the General Assembly, the Security Council, the Economic and Social Council, the International Court of Justice, the Secretariat, and the Trusteeship Council. Each principal organ is located at the UN headquarters in New York, with the exception of the ICJ, which is located at The Hague in the Netherlands. The General Assembly serves as the largest body of the UN, featuring representation from each of the member states. The Assembly is the UN's primary deliberative body and the forum before which we see most of the highest profile diplomacy take place, as the yearly session features not only ambassadors, but plenty of heads of state. The General Assembly primarily deals with questions of international peace, admission of member states, and the UN budget, all of which require a two-thirds majority vote, while less important votes pass by a simple majority. The Assembly is led by a president, elected for a one-year term. The presidency offers a chance for ambassadors from smaller states to lead the world, as few states who have boasted a president of the General Assembly can be classified as major powers, the closest candidate for that honour being Canada in 1952. Instead of being dominated by these major powers, the presidency frequently features states like Mexico, Afghanistan, Liberia, St. Lucia, and currently the Maldives. The next is the Security Council. The Council is tasked with maintaining international peace and security, and has succeeded at least to the degree that recent wars generally have been contained to the region, not global scale. The Council's membership is limited to 15 states at any given time, with 10 seats rotating and 5 permanent seats awarded to the 5 main allies: the United States, United Kingdom, France, the Russian Federation, and the People's Republic of China. The 10 rotating members of the council are elected for two-year terms. India, Ireland, Kenya, Mexico, and Norway will rotate out later this year, while Albania, Brazil, Gabon, Ghana, and the United Arab Emirates will rotate next year. The permanent members, ironically, have gone through a few changes themselves. Initially, the Soviet Union held a permanent seat, but the seat passed to the Russian Federation following the Soviet fall. The People's Republic of China's seat initially was held by the Republic of China, which still survives as Taiwan. However, following Mao Zedong's overthrow of Chiang Kai-shek's national government, the United Nations eventually expelled the Republic of China on October 25, 1971, and Taiwan has since lost even its observer status. Although the General Assembly relies on the good faith of member states to carry out its resolutions, the Security Council's resolutions are binding on all member states. These resolutions include mandating peaceful resolutions to disputes, imposing sanctions, participating in a multinational peacekeeping force, and authorizing to use force when a breach of the peace has occurred or is imminent. However, the five permanent members each have a veto over any proposal before the council. So, matters affecting any of the five generally are usually doomed to fail, leaving affected states to resort to customary international law to solve their disputes. Moving to more peaceful matters, we come to the Economic and Social Council. The Council has jurisdiction over matters of economy, social welfare, environment, and international development. The Council has 54 members, elected by the General Assembly for 3 years, with 18 seats up each year. The Council currently has 30 subsidiary bodies, ranging from regional commissions to bodies concerning criminal justice, women's rights, geographical names, and economic, social, and cultural rights. Next comes the International Court of Justice, more commonly known as the ICJ, or The Hague. The ICJ serves as the UN's main judicial body and rules on matters of international law and issues advisory opinions. The court is composed of 15 judges, all of whom must be nominated by the Permanent Council of Arbitration, then win elections before both the General Assembly and the Security Council. The judges must be from different states and may not hold political, administrative, or professional office during their 9-year terms. Although the court frequently convenes in its entirety, it may form chambers of 3 judges to deal with particular categories of cases, and decisions by the chambers carry the weight of the full court. Notably, the court cannot compel a state to appear before it. Instead, it must rely on the state's consent. This may be achieved by the parties to a dispute meeting one of 3 criteria: submitting a special agreement to the court, being state parties to a treaty that provides the court with jurisdiction over the dispute, or having all made declarations of their consent to the court's jurisdiction under the ICJ statute. Continuing our tour of the UN, we come next to the Secretariat. This body is the boots-on-the-ground organ of the UN, led by the Secretary-General and responsible for the UN's day-to-day business. The Secretary-General is nominated by the Security Council and elected by the General Assembly for a renewable 5-year term. They're assisted by thousands of UN staff members who carry out UN missions throughout the world. When you see UN personnel working out in the field on development or relief missions, this is typically the body overseeing their efforts on a day-to-day basis. The final principal organ of the UN is the Trusteeship Council. The council was established in 1945 to provide supervision for 11 UN trust territories under the supervision of 7 member states. The purpose of the council was to guide the territories under trusteeship towards being able to stand on their own as states in their own right. The council's rules initially required it to meet annually, but the council amended its rules to require meetings only when required shortly before suspending operations in 1994, when all the trust territories had attained self-government or independence. The Council remains inactive, but when it is active, it's composed of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. However, despite the Council's inactive status, it continues to elect a President and Vice President so that it may be ready for action if called upon. The return to the Trusteeship Council may be on the horizon, however, as there have been calls to redefine the scope of the Council's duties to include environmental stewardship, though no decision has been taken to this point. So that's the UN and its principal organs in a nutshell. If you enjoyed this video, let us know your thoughts in the comments down below. You can also talk to us on Twitter and on our Discord server to discuss all things UN. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you next time. Also, be sure to subscribe and hit the bell icon to be notified every time we release a video. Special thanks to our Patreon backers who make videos like this one possible. And if you want to see your name at the end of videos, just like these people, you too can back us on Patreon. The link to that is in the description.
Well, howdy there, internet people. It's Beau again. So today we are going to talk about some polling. We're going to talk about some polling that was conducted and how, even though that polling isn't really surprising, it's counterintuitive. Most people think that it's odd, even though it's just kind of how things normally work. And we're going to talk about how that polling sets the stage for some major difficulties on the foreign policy scene when it comes to the future plans of both the United States and of Israel. Right after this started, and I mean right after, my inbox started filling up with the question of why would they do this? What were they hoping to accomplish? And I said the goal was to provoke an overreaction. When an organization engages in an operation like the one that occurred on October 7th, the goal is to provoke an overreaction, to provoke a security clampdown. The people behind the strategy of the Palestinian forces wanted what you're seeing on your screens because they know it generates outrage. And it turns the bystander into somebody who is sympathetic, the person who is sympathetic into somebody who is active. It grows their force. And it provokes outrage in the international community. That's why they want it. That's why operations like this are conducted. And this isn't just a thing dealing with Palestinians. This is a strategy that has been deployed all over the world. And that's generally what happens. When the overreaction occurs, it helps the smaller force. Okay, so what's the polling say? The polling was conducted in the West Bank and in central and southern Gaza. I'm assuming they didn't conduct polling in northern Gaza for obvious reasons. The big parts of this that are going to matter, 60% want the Palestinian Authority dissolved. Support for Hamas has increased across the board. In the West Bank, it has tripled. So, what does this mean? It means that the bystander became sympathetic and the person who was sympathetic became active. So, as far as Israeli plans, it is incredibly unlikely that they will be able to defeat Hamas because there are now new supporters. It is incredibly unlikely that they will be able to degrade Hamas because there are new supporters. For the U.S., the U.S. plan at this point hinged on a couple of things. First, it hinged on Israel being able to degrade Hamas to the point where they would be combat ineffective. The U.S. plan didn't actually need for them to be defeated, but needed them combat ineffective for a while, because the U.S. plan was for the Palestinian Authority to assert governance over Gaza. If, as it seems, the current forces within Gaza are not going to be degraded and made combat ineffective, and the majority of people want the Palestinian Authority dissolved, well, that presents some real issues. When I went over the three things that the U.S. was kind of angling for after that Security Council vote, people asked what the plan B was. I don't think there is one. But based on this polling, they had better start coming up with one. Because it does not appear that the U.S. plan or the Israeli plan is going to be successful. This is pretty predictable. This is how this works. When you are talking about this kind of irregular conflict, this is what happens. I will put the video from, I think it published on the 9th and was recorded on the 8th. I'll put it down below. At this point, I do not see a way that this ends without another cycle. I would hope that people file all of this information away. So the next time the politicians come out and talk about using this overwhelming force, it's acknowledged that it doesn't work. It plays well for the cameras, but it doesn't actually solve the problem. I am not aware of anything other than a full mobilization of the UN and putting thousands of troops in between the two sides for an extended period, while simultaneously pumping a massive amount of aid into Gaza that even stands a chance of stopping another cycle now. This was, you can go back and watch that video. This was pretty predictable. But I don't know, consider it my optimistic nature, I was hopeful that something would change. It does not look like it's going to. It is important to remember that the next time, because rest assured at this point, that next time seems pretty inevitable, that everybody remembers the mistakes of this time. These mistakes, this cycle, it has been going on for decades. It doesn't work. Even if this polling is off, and I know somebody is going to try to suggest that, even if it is off by, cut it in half. Cut it in half. And support still doubled. These types of conflicts are nothing more than PR campaigns with violence. If you cannot grasp that, there is no way to win. In conflicts like this, it is the responsibility of everybody to acknowledge that this ends at a negotiation table. And the goal should be to get there as quickly as possible. Because it doesn't end anywhere. It just keeps going. Anyway, it's just a thought. Y'all have a good day.
And you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Politico reports a $2 million missile versus a $2,000 drone. The Pentagon is worried over cost of the Ansar Allah attacks in the Red Sea. Quote, that quickly becomes a problem because the most benefit is in their favor, according to one military expert. For insight into this, let's turn to our next guest. He holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. One of the most prolific writers of our time. His latest book is entitled Revolting Capital Racism and Radicalism in Washington, D.C., 1900 to 2000. Dr. Gerald Horn, as always, sir, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
As American warships rack up kills against Houthi drones and missiles in the Red Sea, Pentagon officials are increasingly alarmed, not just at the threat to U.S. naval forces and international shipping, but at the growing cost of keeping them safe. And a couple of things, Dr. Horn. One, it's not only Pentagon officials that are increasingly alarmed. It's maritime insurance companies. It's maritime corporations that are concerned about this. And this is nothing new, or this is nothing out of the norm. This is what happens in insurgent conflicts and guerrilla warfare. Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, this crisis that has now spread to the Red Sea as a direct outgrowth of the war crimes being committed in historic Palestine has a certain inevitability to it. What I mean by that is you have these major shipping firms, including those cited in Denmark, including those cited, quite frankly, in the United States, which routed the union, the National Maritime Union, because it had the left-wing leadership in the United States. Speaking of the founder of that union, Ferdinand Smith, a black man of Jamaican origin. And so now they fly under flags of convenience. They don't necessarily fly under the Danish flag or the U.S. flag. They fly under the flag of Liberia or the Marshall Islands, which has converted these work sites into what are referred to as floating slums, where workers are treated shabbily, and that's a euphemism. And at the same time, you see that this avoidance of the Red Sea because of the crisis in Yemen, the $2,000 drone versus the $2 million dollar missile, as you put it, has led to ships diverting to the Cape of Good Hope, that is to say, to South Africa. Now, on the one hand, that could be a bonanza for the Pretoria-based regime, but I'm sure the comrades there are thinking of how they can leverage this for further gain, perhaps calling conferences with their counterparts in Yemen and Egypt with regard to how they can raise the prices on these North Atlantic shipping firms. At the same time, I should also say that the current unrest in South Africa, induced by the fact that former President Jacob Zuma has now broken with the ruling party of the African National Congress, is going to introduce a certain kind of unrest, particularly in his home province, KwaZulu-Natal, which abuts the Indian Ocean, where ships heading towards the Cape of Good Hope are within hailing distance of. Likewise, you see that Malaysia, that Southeast Asian nation that has a predominantly Muslim population, has just barred Israeli ships or ships headed to Israel from their waters. They abut the strategically sited Straits of Malacca, and that will induce further crisis for the Israeli economy. I dare say that their neighbors in Indonesia, the largest predominantly Islamic nation on planet Earth, will probably emulate their Malaysian brothers and sisters, which will present the further problems for the Israelis. And likewise, pay attention to the frame of pro-Zionist support in the United States of America, not only reflected on campuses, which we've received an earful about, but also increasingly reflected in the ruling elite. I'm speaking of Ian Bremmer, a major risk consultant with close ties to Wall Street, who has raised questions about the future viability of the U.S. relationship to Israel. He also raised the question that many of us have been asking, which is that if Israel is such a close ally of the United States, why was it that Prime Minister Netanyahu during the Obama years not only publicly condemned the nuclear agreement with Iran that U.S. imperialism saw as important strategically, but flew to Washington at the behest of the opposing Republicans and spoke to Congress denouncing that accord in no uncertain terms. And yet, this is supposedly the closest ally of U.S. imperialism. I think that we've referred previously to a column in the Washington Post by the CIA stenographer de facto, speaking of David Ignatius, who spoke in similar sour terms about Israel and its relationship to the United States of America. And I should also say that it's quite curious, is it not, that with regard to these convoys that are being proposed to chaperone ships through the Red Sea, that the Saudis are not on the list. The only neighboring country that's on the list is Bahrain, which of course happens to house a major U.S. Facility. That is an indication of the unpopularity of this particular maneuver. And I should also say that this is going to have significant impact on oil prices and inflation, because BP, formerly British Petroleum, has already announced that it will be seeking to circumvent the Red Sea in terms of bringing oil from that part of the world to Western Europe, and particularly to Rotterdam and the Netherlands. They're already boycotting, speaking of the Western Europeans, Russian oil. And so one has to wonder, will this also lead to not only a spike in oil prices, but more dependence upon oil shipments from the United States of America? And that's not only to speak of inflation in terms of energy, also I should reference here liquefied natural gas, but also in terms of simple items such as toys. If they're adding thousands of miles from Asia to Western European and North American markets by circumventing the Red Sea and sailing via the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, that means more oil being burned in these ships. And then I think it may even give more leverage to China, because China, as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, has built train tracks that rumble from eastern China, the manufacturing site of a good deal of the global economy, all the way to Western Europe. If ships are not able to go through the Suez Canal because of the crisis in Yemen, perhaps they will revert to these Chinese trains rumbling across the Eurasian continent. So we see that all in all, this is a major crisis for world imperialism. It will also expose, I should say, the fact that Abu Dhabi, part of the United Arab Emirates, has been playing a double game. On the one hand, a mouthing rhetoric against the Israeli occupiers, but at the same time, reportedly, supposedly, having a land corridor from the Emirates to Israel, easing pressure on the Zionist state, because, of course, they are not necessarily unhappy about Hamas, seen as dangerously close to the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not unhappy about them being battered. That will add to a crisis in the Emirates, a crisis in Abu Dhabi, and therefore magnifying the entire crisis of world imperialism.
Look, the main thing that I keep coming back to in my own mind is, like, how are we still at the point in 2023 where it really seems like nothing has changed since, like, medieval times? It just so happens to be the case that we have better weapons now, right? So conflicts are, like, more deadly and more dangerous. But, like, the ethics and the morals have not changed at all. You know, I mean, you got this sense, certainly I did, that after World War II, there was a little bit of an awakening. You know, after World War II, people came to the conclusion, all right, this fucking sucked. World War I was disastrous. So many people died. World War II was disastrous. You had this psycho who was committing genocide, and so many people died. And, you know, we had the Nuremberg Tribunals. We had the Geneva Conventions. We had international law that was supposed to be serious and real and look out for human rights and prevent atrocities from happening in the future. The fact of the matter is, it's fake. It's all fake. It was all a framework to make people feel good that there are rules that will be objectively applied and that justice is blind. Justice is not blind, and the rules are not applied equally or fairly. And that's where we are right now. It's a total slap in the face. And it's a real wake-up call when you realize, holy shit, nothing has changed since those days. Because Israel, in broad daylight, can commit the worst atrocities imaginable, and the U.S. government, which is the world's sole superpower, which is backing them, arming them, funding them, will just proceed as if nothing happened. You know, I saw Anthony Blinken tweeting something, basically sucking himself off and sucking the U.S. off about how we're going to continue to lead with diplomacy going into the new year like we always have as the world leader. And it's like, can you at least have the bare minimum amount of shame to shut the fuck up right now? Because there's not only blood on your hands, there's blood all over your body, bitch. So anyway, disastrous stuff, and I hope it changes, but I'm not going to hold my breath. Credit to everybody who's out there in the streets protesting. Credit to the governments that are now stepping up and breaking with the orthodoxy. It's good to see that the U.S., in a sense, stands alone in the international community. It stands alone. And look, what does that say about us? If we look in the mirror, what's looking back at us is not pretty.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your brother, Brian Mary Deez Ogaya. And welcome to this Class War Better Pro podcast episode. The United Nations and its lack of action on Israel. I'm recording this on the eve of Christmas Eve. I'm recording this on December 23rd, 2023. And news has just come out that the Security Council, I mean, this technically, I guess, happened yesterday, but the Security Council in the United Nations allowed a statement that is just hogwash to finally get through its iron wall of penetration when it comes to Israel. There are many questions about the United Nations' inability in the present crisis within Palestine and Israel. Their inability to actually do anything to stop what is happening there. There are deeper questions, especially within younger generation, surrounding why, and most of the younger generation, having grown up with the internet, know the answer to this, but why the UN has been unable to stop Israel from expanding its settlements throughout Palestine and Palestinian territory. Those questions are mostly policy driven. We do not typically have discussions anymore about the role of the United Nations in the development and maintenance of the order of things within the world, because we take the United Nations as it is currently structured as a given. Now, if you go back to the late 40s, the early 50s, into the 60s, conversations surrounding the purpose of the United Nations was at the forefront of not just liberals, and I'm talking liberal philosophers and liberal diplomats, but also among many radicals and radical-leaning people. Because the United Nations was considered a body with an absolute sky level of potential. And if it was constructed right, if it was, quote, done right, the United Nations could have changed the world completely. But in many eyes, especially those people who leaned more radical, more leftist, the United Nations failed to do that. And the conversations as to why the United Nations failed to do that ran deep and ran far. It was really the 60s and the 70s that the conclusions I'm going to talk about in this podcast became solidified. People on the left started understanding, to a great extent, why the United Nations was put into place. Admittedly, the United Nations played a role in developing the national structure of republicanism throughout the world. It played a role in depressing socialist constructs in what we think of as national formations throughout the world also. In order to be recognized by the General Assembly, you had to have a commitment to the Republican principle or Republicanist principles. You had to some extent, agree to keep yourself in the global economic system in a way that would benefit those who had been the colonial and imperial leaders of the past 400 nearly. If you failed to do that, then yeah, they may let you be a part of the General Assembly, but you were really going to have no power, you were going to have no real say-so, you were going to be isolated because you were bucking the system that Europeans wanted to exist. Which leads me to the first point that you need to understand when it comes to the United Nations. It was constructed as an institution to further the Eurocentric, imperial-centric domination of the world by other means after it became pretty clear at World War II's conclusion that direct, overt, aggressive imperialism was no longer going to be tolerated throughout the world. The world had come together, black, brown, red, yellow, and white. I put white last because they are the smallest group on the planet. The world had come together to not only halt, but completely interrupt and destroy the menace that European imperialism had created. And that menace was Hitler. That menace was Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany was a reproduction of all of the horrid institutions within imperialism condensed and taken to their natural conclusion for the world to see. And it scared the hell out of Western Asian democracies. I'm sorry, Europe. European democracies. Because they thought they were invincible. Even after World War I. And that imperial poison that they had been pumping throughout the world knocked on their door, kicked it in, and showed them that they were as susceptible to the death that they brought to the rest of the world as the rest of the world had been susceptible to them. After the world helped West Asia clean up the mess it had created, the world was not going back to pre-World War II constructs. Black, brown, red, yellow people were no longer going to allow themselves to be subjugated by a group of people who had brought the world to the brink of utter destruction, not via the atomic bomb, but by creating the fertile grounds to produce something as disastrous and disgusting as Hitler and the Nazis. They had lost credibility on the world stage, as they had really never had it, but it was certain. So, in light of the collapse of the League of Nations, the United Nations was formed. It was supposed to, or it was said to be, a structure that was going to democratize the world. The world was going to be able to come together in one place to create the solutions that the world needed to be safe and yada, yada, yada. But the reality was, and this was clear within 25 years of the institution being established, the reality was the United Nations was increasingly and forever an institution that allowed European countries to remain dominant over their former colonies and to impose imperial constraints over the wills of the people who they had dominated. As this became known, and it was more known to the General Assembly within 20 years of the institution's establishment, as it became unavoidable, though, and as people had to see it for what it was, fighting that tendency in the institution became of the utmost importance. That led to books and papers and speeches decrying the internal imperial mandate that was unstated but always practiced within the United Nations. This led to people questioning its not only validity, but its viability over the long term if the institution was not going to change what it stood for. Luckily for European countries, most of those voices who had those claims could be dismissed as radicals. They had no importance. Let them fly. Let them go. Who cares? But that analysis never went away. Now, here in the United States, the right wing, which has done a great job of painting the United Nations as some rogue institution that has its own secret police and can at any whim declare martial law over the United States and take over every section of the United States, they have really done a good job of convincing people that the United Nations is an institution that it is not. They have done a real good job about of that, leading people to ignore what the United Nations actually is, which is an institution which perpetuates the imperial control of the United States. Now, for those of you who doubt this, I get that. But let's look briefly at the idea of the General Assembly and the Security Council. The dominant countries on the Security Council are Eurocentric. They're all Eurocentric. For good measure, they have a black friend. They also have a yellow friend. But it's Eurocentric dominated. The General Assembly, which looks more like the rest of the world, is kind of like the House of Representatives in the United States. It has tons of power. until it meets the Senate. And the Senate has the capacity to completely slap down everything that the House of Representatives does, even if the House has a 3/4 majority who says this needs to go through. The Senate, as a smaller body, can say, nope, we believe we should go another way, goodbye. Unless you change this, 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 this. The sense of a structure like this, where you have a larger institution that represents the population in general, and then you have a smaller institution that supposedly represents the same population, isn't balance or check, as we are told here. Or at least not as we believe it to be. The balance is what the population wants versus what the economic people want, the people who have the money. And to win as a senator, there has not been a populist-based, a leftist senator brought into the ranks of the Senate class in some time. Because the amount of money that you need to win a Senate race, the type of backing that you need to win a Senate race, is so significant that you are beholden to the power brokers, the money men of the state that you are a senator from. You don't have the capacity to be a populist candidate unless you are blessed to be one by those who have the money. The Security Council is the same way. The Security Council is the same way. They are beholden to the most powerful body of countries in the world. And if you are not aligned with them, even if you're on the Security Council, you are nearly irrelevant. Because the role of the Security Council is to keep at the front of the United Nations what is best for the Eurocentric imperial order that has been reigning the world for quite a long time. They would disagree with this, but it's the truth. It's the truth. The Security Council does good things, just like the Senate does good things. But most of the time, they do what they do to protect the status quo, even at the cost of something that would be vitally important to the health and well-being of the global population. And they do it because the Eurocentric imperial paradigm requires it. Not only does the imperial paradigm require it, but usually the wealth and power and prestige of European countries. By the way, the United States is a European country. It may be on another continent, but it is, just like Australia is. This is the truth behind the placement of the Security Council in relationship to the General Assembly. The General Assembly is there to give credibility to the Security Council. If the General Assembly was not there, the Security Council would make the decisions that they make, but people would see the institution for what it was. So the General Assembly gives coverage to the Security Council, just as the House of Representatives gives coverage to the Senate. In reality, in any country, there does not need to be doesn't need to be two election representative bodies. That just makes absolutely no sense. You have a body that's for the entire population. You call everybody together, you make decisions, and then you have an executive, or you have an executive council or legislation or whatever that signs stuff into law, does the management portion for the administration of the state institutions, and that's it. The only reason you put that smaller body in between the person or persons at the top and that bigger body is to squeeze out the things that the people who have the money don't want. I mean, think about this. And I'll get back to the, I'll use this one. Think about this. The global community, the quote, international community, the global community has been voting for 30 years to stop the expansion of settlements within Palestine, to limit Israel's ability to expand settlements. They've been voting for this for 30 years. Why has nothing been done to stop them from expanding their settlements? Because the Security Council, the one that is Eurocentrically based, continues to veto it and stand in the way of stopping them from doing what they're doing. Now, in my first episode on Israel, I said Israel has some of the smartest people living there. There is no way that these smart people did not know that sometime in the near future, what they were doing to the Palestinians was going to result in individuals coming through and doing something horrific to the Israeli population. I had a question from somebody who said, well, now it's just like you're blaming the Israelis. Within every defense and intelligence organ in any state across the world, they have a risk assessment unit who says, because of the conditions on the ground, this is going to be the response, this is going to be what we should expect, and all of that information is sent to the proper authorities, to people who need to know that. We have found out now that Israel was warned. So they knew. Well, you know this is going to happen and you do nothing, and you have a great military and a great intelligence service that can do something and you do nothing. Come on. Wake up. But if the General Assembly had been listened to for 30 years, if they had been listened to, the settlements had been ceased, Israel had been pushed into respecting the borders that they were supposed to respect from like 50 years ago, the aggressiveness of the Palestinian people would have waned significantly. It would have waned significantly. And it's possible that relationships 50 years into the future, right now, would have been cooled and friendly. But the Security Council, seeing Israel as a tool for maintaining order in the Middle East, refused to let that happen, because the bigger Israel is, the bigger footprint that the United States and its Eurocentric allies will have. And thus, their ability to control the resources in that area, including the people, including the the authorities in that area, is expanded. It's increased. I mean, when Joe Biden said, if Israel had not been created, we would have to create one, he kind of told on the entire domestic position of, diplomatic position of the United States in Europe. Israel is key to Eurocentric control of the region. Thus, the Security Council, seeing this truth, their job is to make sure that what Europe wants, Europe gets. What the rest of the world wants is secondary or tertiary, depending on what Europe wants. The rest of the world was right. The Security Council was wrong. There is a deep disturbance that's happening within the international community. You know, the other countries that aren't Eurocentric. And that's why I'm actually doing this episode. There is a deep disturbance. There is questions of legitimacy of the United Nations and the Security Council that is bubbling up throughout the world. That's why the Security Council allowed this to go through. Because for the first time since World War II, since the League of Nations, a global institution is having its viability challenged, even though it's not directly being challenged. It is happening, people are questioning it, and it scared the hell out of the Eurocentric members of the Security Council, because once that institution falls in viability by the rest of the world, Eurocentricity is done. It's done. Now, I'm not saying that as a person who's like, yeah, let the UN fall. Oh my God, it's so wonderful. That's not what I'm saying. Because I think the years following the United Nations failure, you know, it falls apart, would be actually quite terrifying for the world. But what I am saying is, the institutional crisis, the validity of institutions, democratic institutions within this country, and the validity of what used to be called the international liberal order. So institutions that promoted the international liberal order, the fact that those questions are arising at this moment is humbling. Is humbling. It says to a person like me, who has been following this stuff off and on for quite some time, it says to a person like me that we are really headed towards unprecedented times. We are really headed towards unprecedented times. If the United Nations increases in seeing its validity challenged, privately and or publicly, we are going to come to a moment in time where we see countries opt out of the United Nations. And if that begins to happen, then the movement towards another unifying body will begin. And if that begins to happen, you will see a dramatic fall of prestige by European powers. But before you see that fall, you will see an attempt by those European powers to force people back into the United Nations. And if that force is too aggressive, as it often seems to be, then the fear that I have is that you are going to see unravel in this world the order that has reigned supreme over the last 70 years. And what happens when that begins to unravel is anyone's guess. I am not in the position of saying I know. But what I am in the position of saying I know, is that the Security Council has to step up now and prove that it is a legitimate arm of democracy. It listens to its public and it says, okay, enough is enough. Israel, you are in the wrong here. It's time to make significant changes and to allow for the Palestinians to live. If the Security Council cannot do that, and I kind of get the sense that it cannot do that, we are looking at a crisis in the United Nations unfolding over the next year. I am hopeful that the diplomatic organs will go to work and get the Security Council in line and actually move in the direction of solving this problem. There is more that I want to say about the United Nations, and I want to do so by first answering the question, why the United Nations is important for world peace, especially for this newer generation. And really, before I answer that question, let me just say that we have, thanks to technology, a new United Nations forum, and that forum is the internet. The internet. People are talking to people across borders everywhere throughout the world. Everywhere. And now, the United Nations needs to take its rightful position in leading this globe into a new era of cooperation and peace and cleaning up the environment and just doing the will of the people. If it cannot do that, Lord help the world. But I digress. Why the UN, why the United Nations is important for world peace, and I should definitely add, for this newer generation. In order to truthfully understand this, we have to understand what many in what used to be called the Third World has actually been pushing for over the last 70, 80 years of the existence of the United Nations. And that is for a global, human-centric model of directly communicating with one another and diplomatically dealing with one another. I believe it is arguable that since the Europeans started imperialism, the two types of worlds that have collided, because, you know, Samuel Huntington wrote that book, The Clash of Cultures, The Clash of Civilizations, I think it was actually titled. But essentially, it was the clash of the barbarians' culture, that's the non-European culture, and the European culture, which really upheld violence. Who's really the barbarian? Anyway, on the one hand, you had a thing-centric society, or a violent-centric society, or an aggressive-centric society, and on the other hand, most of the time, you had human-centric societies. Now, in the past 80 years, to kind of promote the idea that Europe might be moving towards this more human-centric concept of living, they've been talking a lot about humanitarianism. But humanitarianism, so far as Europeans are concerned, is not a political, economic way of structuring relationships. It is a tool that might be utilized in the diplomatic scheme of the imperial structure that we live with presently. Humanitarianism is supposedly at the heart of the United Nations, yet the Security Council seems to not be concerned with that heart. It is more concerned, as I said earlier, with perpetuating the will and control of European countries. That stated, human-centric is, in essence, the wave of the future. It is the new reality that we are entering into, and it is what people are calling for from every country of the world. It goes beyond humanitarianism, which could be a new system of relationship, but it says at the crux of every decision, And this is just basic. This isn't even the complexity of human-centric thinking. But at the crux of every decision is how is it going to impact not only humanity presently, but, and I borrow this from the indigenous people from this continent and from Africa, and I probably could imagine from Asia too. How are the decisions being made today and implemented? How are they going to impact seven generations in the future? Now, I already know what Eurocentric thinkers will say. Oh, well, we can't possibly know that. That's funny. Because corporations are expected to possibly know what their revenue streams are for the next 30 plus years. In fact, the Koch brothers supposedly had developed a system to be able to predict, and they have been proven right over the last 30, 40 years, to predict profits decades into the future. Well, if they can predict profits decades into the future, we can predict to a certain extent what decisions made and implemented today are going to do, or the impact that it's going to have in the future for seven generations. We can do that. But see, that idea, which seems so impossible to some, is what the United Nations should be actually dealing with. And in fact, the research that has gone on through bodies that are attached to the United Nations when it comes to things like climate change, 40, 50, 60 years ago, you know, they were all over the place. All the research was showing, you know, various differences in severity of climate change and what would happen. But as we've gotten closer to the year 2000, and technology has advanced, their prediction and their predictive models have begun to clarify to a startling point, and this is repeated often if you read just a little bit of the literature, things that they thought would take 100 years from the 1960s and 70s, 100 years to occur, 150, 200 years to occur, some of those things are now going to be taking place within living memory for people who are just being born today. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but that's 100 years. I mean, if a person today lives to be 80 years old, then they're going to die in 2100. Yeah, but when we're talking living memory, we're talking things that they expected to happen 150 years from now, occurring in the 2050s or 2060s. Things that they thought would happen towards the end of the century occurring now or in the 2030s. The timetables, in other words, are moving up. The new United Nations would have to take seriously the idea of international justice and take it out of the hands of a Eurocentric body like the Security Council. Because justice often eludes those who try to exert the will of the law onto Europe. For this newer generation, they know where the problems have been and who the problems have been created by. They understand it is a generational cycle that must be stopped. The United Nations is an institute that must be conformed to make this secession happen. Secession, by the way, is not about land or acquisition of land or things like that. Secession is stopping, preventing it from happening. That generational cycle has to be halted. The United Nations is the brain trust of the world, if it is allowed to be. But it can only be the brain trust of the world if the Eurocentric mind at the helm of the Security Council is done away with. The world is facing existential crises that it must come together and solve. I want to speak a little bit about that, and this has less to do with politics and more to do with metaphysics. The Hopi, in their mythologies, tell the story of three great shakings. The first great shaking, the Hopis attribute to World War I. The second great shaking, they attribute to World War II. During the second great shaking, this thing called the gourd of ashes is dropped. They attribute that to, obviously, the atomic bomb. The third great shaking, they started reporting in the 1980s that they were seeing signs that the third great shaking was going to occur. They didn't know when, but they knew that there were signs pointing to it occurring, and that in some of their memories, especially certain young children being born in the 80s and the 90s, it was likely they were going to see the third great shaking. However, in latter years, one of their elders reported that there was an attempt by the indigenous people, and I suspect by God, to lessen the impact, to lessen the severity of the third great shaking. I have been adamant in my thinking as I meditate and I pray about what the Hopis have said and what they have communicated with us. I've been adamant in believing that what we are seeing now, what we witness as the global climate crisis, is an attempt by the Great Spirit to get us to rearrange our thinking so that if the third shaking does take place, it is dramatically less severe than it was going to be. It is dramatically less severe than it was going to be. Well, we are here at this present moment looking at a body in the United Nations that has the will of the people within it. And the will of the people is saying, get your act together and act on this. Get legislation passed in the United Nations that pushes countries to do what is right when it comes to this climate crisis. In order to do that, there's going to have to be, and I know Europeans have no great interest in this, big business is going to have to be brought into alignment with the realities of the time. If they are not willing to be brought into alignment with the reality of the times, they are going to have to be made to be brought into alignment with the reality of time, of this time, because we're now out of runway. And young people know this. Quick note about young folks and people who are protesting when it comes to the Palestinians and Israelis. They know that you can't play games with this stuff anymore. That too long, people have wanted to play games and say, oh, it's just politics, it's just politics. These are people's lives. End of note. Big business has no excuse anymore. And they must be allowed to have no excuse anymore. The reality of the time is we need business to not continue as usual. And the United Nations can be and should be a part of that. Unfortunately, and this is something that often isn't talked about, the United Nations, just like most institutions throughout the world, has begun to be conquered by corporate money. The fascist rhetoric of a lot of big multinational corporations, which is hidden in its monetary control of various institutions has reached the United Nations. This is one of the reasons it has been so slow to act aggressively in pushing the institutions that are outside of itself towards problem solving that the world is begging it to engage in. This brings me to the conclusive point of this episode. What now? What now? The United Nations must be reformed. The liberal order, the liberal international order, must be reformed. We are now to a point where Palestine and the atrocities that are being visited upon its citizens are telling us that the atrocities visited upon the world by institutional structures that refuse to bend to the will of justice and righteousness and truth and dignity and honor and humanness cannot be tolerated. I believe this is the gift that is in the tragedy of Palestine. Just as people said there were gifts within the tragedy that was the Holocaust. Never again. We shall never let this happen again, we were told. We were told that we learned the value of people's lives based on the Holocaust. I would say that we learned the value of white lives based on the Holocaust. Those who are not deemed white, well, kill them all you want. Presently, I think that's being proven on multiple continents. Palestine is telling us it's over. It's done. The status quo is broken. And the Great Spirit is spoken. Y'all better realize things are not going back to what they used to be. They're not. They can't. This includes the United Nations. The legitimacy of the primacy of the United States is collapsing right in front of our eyes. The world, which looked at the United States as the beacon that conservatives like to describe it as, no longer believe the United States is that beacon. Not because of Joe Biden, not even because of Trump, but because of a process that has unfolded for the last 50 years. You now have two generations that clung to hope that the United States would rise to the occasion of global leadership that all these former colonies wished they would. Most of these former colonies, as Dr. King pointed out, used the United States as an inspiration as they marched towards independence. They used the United States as inspiration, only to see the country that they were inspired by turn against them, destroy their liberation hopes, destroy their collective dreams. And we are now faced with the reality that comes from that destruction. The world is plotting how to get from underneath the United States. And the fear that I see happening in the Security Council's decision is that the world has moved on from the U.S. I tell you this today, ladies and gentlemen, if it was not for the institutional stranglehold outside of the United Nations that the U.S. has throughout the world, I'm going to tell you right now, the United Nations would have collapsed because of this Palestine-Israel conflict, the slaughtering of innocent people in Palestine. The United Nations would have collapsed. That is how done with the United States junk the world is. And I don't say this with enthusiasm. There is no enthusiasm in my voice. There is no enthusiasm in my mind. I say this because I feel it and I see it and I sense it. The tragedy of it all is that mixed in with the rest of the world being tired of the United States is this feeling that the U.S. could still be saved. And this is the only thing that's keeping the United Nations standing. Only thing. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, that's contradictory. That's contradictory. You said that the United Nations would have collapsed over this Palestine thing. Yes. 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 Because so many people, if they had the opportunity, if they had the freedom, so many countries would have left the United Nations over this. That the only people left within it would have been people who couldn't escape the United States influence. Probably about half of the countries would have been left in the United Nations, which would have made it irrelevant. Hence, it would have collapsed. But, even as the other structure would have been being built, there would have been a hope that the United States would have come to its senses and would have become what the world needed it to become. And so, there would have still been partnership between the new institution and the United Nations. That's the contradictory part. The United States needs to wake up. They really do. If they don't, there's going to come a point in time in the next 10 to 20 years when the world's going to leave it behind. And particularly the people in this country who believe that the U.S. is indestructible, they're going to wake up and find that they are pariahs throughout the world. They're pariahs. That the world wants nothing to do with citizens from the U.S. The same might become true for Europe. Last thing I'll say, then I'll close this out. Baba Vanga, the mystic from East Europe, West Asia, the eastern part of West Asia, as it should be called. She spoke of a possible future when the world would reject immigrants from the United States and Europe. Something devastating had happened in this potential future she saw, and radiation or some other disaster had made it near impossible to continue feeding the people in the United States and Europe. And the Global South rejected millions of people from these Eurocentric areas. Because, and she recorded this, the reason they rejected European people and people from the United States was because of the poison. The poison, not the radiation, but the poison to the culture that these countries saw within the citizens from these places. People forget, but during COVID, the first taste of that began. The future is here, y'all. The future is here. What are these institutions going to do to ensure that the world doesn't leave behind the United States? I want to thank y'all for listening. I'm your brother, Vladimir Diso Gaya. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me on at radio, the number 4AL.net. You can also reach out to me at my WordPress blog, Class War Battlefield Podcast blog, where I post all of these. Also, you can find the podcast at Spotify and Amazon and other places. I actually have to update the postings there immediately, or soon to be immediate. And if you want to support the show, do so through PayPal. I am letting the Patreon thing go. I'm not really going to do Patreon. I thought I would, but I'm not. But PayPal and Cash App, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast. $2, $5, $10, $20, $30, $50, whatever you could do, it helps. And finally, for a extended list of leftist media sources, just go to my WordPress, Class War Battlefield Podcast, and check in there. I have an updated list that you can actually draw from. These are all media sites. They're not, and when I say media, I mean visual. There's a couple of podcasts, but I don't really do like written, but I probably should sooner rather than later. Anyway, thanks y'all for being here with me today. Nearly an hour worth of a show. How many people are going to be tackling the future of the United Nations like this? Not many. Again, I'm your brother, Vladimir Diso Gaya, and I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alone.